This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. On a typical commercial flight, pilots are flying an aircraft at hundreds of miles an hour at 30 to 40,000 feet above sea level in a pressurized metal tube, all the while shouldering the responsibility of hundreds of lives. How psychologically demanding is a profession like this, and what goes into the process of ensuring a pilot is mentally qualified to fly? On the phone with me, Dr. Raymond Hamden, clinical and forensic psychologist. Welcome to the show, Raymond. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much.
Raymond, you're a forensic psychologist. Can you just explain to me what that means and what your training has been like?
My first degree is in clinical psychology. That's where I got my doctorate's professional practice for clinical psychology, and then I did psychoanalysis, and after that, what used to be called political psychology with the University of Maryland, College Park. And then psychology kind of started branching out a lot more, and forensic psychology became a very popular venture, especially because a lot of the media hype around CSI and all the various kinds of interesting programs have been quite glamorized.
Yes.
So forensic psychology is an area that has many various aspects, and my particular area is to profile bad people and also to do critical incident debriefings. So in these processes, we investigate the psychological angle that could involve the legal aspect, whether it's court or a national entity, to determining justice.
Well, the objective of this interview is to sort of understand pilot psychology. Have you had much interaction with pilots and investigations as far as your work is concerned?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was studying commercial piloting before I went into the field of psychology.
Right. Everybody's
since
dream,
then,
isn't
I was
it?
Doing. Yeah, everybody has some things that they have to do before they get into the real world.
Yes.
That was my play area. I just didn't want to end up doing that the rest of my life, even though there's certainly nothing wrong with being a pilot. Mm-hmm. It's quite a wonderful profession, and it does take a lot of stress to be able to venture into that because of the responsibilities that one has. Since that, in my career as a psychologist, I have done evaluations for various airlines on pilot psychology and even assessed people who are going into the profession of piloting.
What does the work entail? What sort of psychological state does it take to be a pilot? Because if you talk to anyone else who, doctors for an example, we rarely talk about the psychological state of a doctor, and their job is just as demanding as a pilot's job would be. Now, how would you compare both those professions?
Well, the doctor is an academic title. It's not a profession. I'm not sure if you're talking about a doctor who's a physician or a doctor who's a psychologist.
A medical doctor.
Or a doctor who's a PhD. Okay, medical. Okay, so you're talking about a physician.
Yes.
The medical examination does not always entail the psychological aspects. However, a physician who is sensitive may pick up on some psychological entities, like the way that the person might think, a history of their emotional stability, and in general, their kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. Now, psychology is a science in which we investigate cognition, emotions, and behavior, the way that the body is working and the way it is affected by the way people think, feel, and behave, and how the environment affects us, whether it's being 35,000 feet above sea level, or if it's a noisy environment, or it's being stuck in a studio by yourself talking to millions of people but can't face them. So all of this has its various kinds of psychological components. The usual psychology of a pilot is a person who likes adventure, who likes to travel, a person who's not exactly confined to one area or another, but likes a variety of functions. Now, there's different kinds of pilots. There's fighter pilots for the military. There's commercial pilots. There's private pilots. There are people who privately own their own aircraft just for the recreation of it. And there's also people who do courier services. So there are various kinds of pilots. What we're finding is a different personality component for each one of these. But it doesn't depend on whether the person's a good pilot as to their personality. It's the personality that takes them into that particular profession. So, for instance, a fighter pilot is a person who can compartmentalize what they do when they finish doing their job. A commercial pilot is a person who's service-oriented, very conscientious about everyone who's on the airplane, and they take their job very consistently and very correctly. They're very planned. decisive and orderly. There's not much room for being spontaneous and flexible. Mm-hmm. It's a very defined guideline profession.
How are pilots psychologically trained for the job? And we do know that they undergo psychological tests before they're even hired. But after that, are they trained to psychologically take on this huge responsibility?
Unfortunately not. And that is something that maybe airlines need to be considering it. Let's look at the reality of this whole situation. As a human being, one person dying from an accident is one person too much on the on any airplane and in any place on the planet. But when we look at it statistically, and I'm certainly not reducing human existence to statistics, mm-hmm. but look at it statistically, there's millions of flights that take off and land every single day on this planet. How many airplane accidents are there? Yes, one accident is way too much. One death is way too much. But when we look at it statistically, that influences the economy of the industry, who may not be considering a person's name, their relations to other people on the planet. Mm-hmm. They're interested in how much does it cost to actually go into psychological investigations on every single person. That's a lot of money. And if we're not going to have an accident in our whole career, or if the statistics show that we're only likely to have one accident, is it worth putting in that kind of money? Unfortunately, that's how industry works. It's economically driven, not humanistically driven.
In your opinion, what is the best indicator of a sound mental health in a commercial airline pilot?
The same as any sound human being anywhere in the world. An individual who is balanced in their life, they have time for productivity, they have time for recreation, they have time for family and friends, and they also have spiritual time. Now, all of those things are composed into one day's 24-hour process. Yep. In other words, waiting until the weekend to have fun is not having a balanced life. Every day, there needs to be time for productivity, where a person is earning an income, they could be doing volunteer work, they could be a student, they could be a house parent, but they're contributing to the community, they're not a burden on it. So they feel pretty good about themselves, that they're part of a community. Recreational means that they recreate non-stressful time every day to do sports or hobbies by themselves or with friends or with family. And every day there's time for their loved ones, whether it's a romantic love with their partner, family love with their children and extended family members, friends. And then the worship is a sense of meditating with a universal connection. Now, this doesn't mean you have to belong to a particular religion. Mm-hmm. You could be non-religious, you could be spiritual, you could be organized, non-organized. It doesn't matter. But what this actually means from the psychological angle is that a person examines their mission statement in life. What are their values and their attitudes? What makes them unique? What is their traditions, their customs? And also, what are their boundaries? What are their ethics and their morals? When a person investigates these definitions for themselves within themselves, and it's called the balance for life, which is the number four, work, play, love, and worship, there's a better chance of being a person who is well stabilized in life, seeking independence, seeking an identity, and having that emotional stability for flexibility and adaptability in the world, and maintaining your responsibility and respectability in everything that you do.
That's advice for all of us, really.
Yes, it is.
And when you talk about pilot psychology, what really affects it? I mean, I can imagine conflict between home and work, burnout and engagement. You have individual differences in stress, consequences of stress, the joys and stresses of air travel, unruly passengers, a whole load of things. Raymond, the reason I ask you this question is because very often the layperson thinks that a pilot flies, puts everything on autopilot and has a very easy time. Could you just go through with me the sort of mental state that they could be in, or they are in, actually, when they take on this huge responsibility?
This responsibility is not as glamorous as movies show it to be, nor is it as dangerous as Denzel Washington's recent movie where he can fly an airplane upside down and still make people alive because he hit the staple of a church somewhere.
Yeah.
Now, that may have been the blessing, actually. But the point being that you're coming up with is a very important point. It doesn't involve just that individual. It involves their environment.
Yes.
The kind of personality of a person who goes into that stressful field, that even if the airplane is on autopilot, he has to be alert or she has to be alert. What if the autopilot kicks off? It usually takes about 15 seconds for the people in the cockpit to realize that the autopilot has kicked off. You only have 3 seconds to react to keep the airplane safe before it's in danger within 8 seconds. This is a research that was done by Dr. Iya Soludilova, who is an aviation psychology specialist.
Mm-hmm.
The work that has been done to look at pilots, their ability to function, also involves the family. The type of lifestyle that a pilot has, usually they're only supposed to fly a certain amount of hours per month. But that family needs to also be ready to know that their loved one is going to be up in the air. They may be gone for one day, they may be gone for a week, depending on the flight, if they're flying commercially, militarily, cargo, or whatever the case may be. The kind of lifestyle that they have is not always consistent. Therefore, the family has got to be in the psychological management of that as well. So not every partner is able to have a husband or a wife who's not constantly available.
Yep.
So there has to be that flexibility in timing, even though there's not that flexibility in managing the career. So in other words, a cockpit pilot cannot just be so flexible to compromise being planned, decisive, and orderly, and ready at any moment that autopilot kicks off. But then in their personal life, they and their family have to be flexible to know that person can be flown out at any time.
Yep.
So when looking at a pilot psychology, we're maybe also looking at the partner as well as the family members at large and how they interact with each other, how they affect each other. If there's a problem at home with the marriage or with one of the kids, wouldn't that logically affect the person's concentration in the cockpit? Or can they compartmentalize their emotional issues at home and stay focused as only a pilot for 8 hours in the cockpit? So those are the things that we would investigate when looking at a patient's psychology, at a pilot's psychology. And the pilot's psychology investigates everything from their management style to their neuropsychological. We do all kinds of instruments that are standardized so we know everything about the way they think, the way they feel, the way they behave. We not only want to look at their cognitive process, we also want to look at neurocognitive processes. With environmental toxicants today, what we're finding is there possibly is 20% of middle-aged men are showing early signs of neurological deterioration.
Mm-hmm.
So clinical psychologists, whether they're specialized in neuropsych or not, can usually detect these. Then they're referred to a neuropsychologist or a neurologist for further investigation. Unfortunately, at this point, we're not sure how many airlines actually do that. Again, it may be an economic decision on the airlines rather than a humanistic necessity.
Even if they go through psychological tests every year, let's just say that is put in place, after a while, you anticipate, you know what these tests are all about. Isn't there a way around it to get past these tests every day, every year when they become routine?
When they become routine, yes, but the part of psychology, when it's correctly initiated, is that it's not routine. There's variations so that people don't get into the habit of testing. And this is something that even teachers can do in the academic system. They can get so used to being tested and retested,
yeah,
they start educating their students on how to put in the right answer so they look good as teachers.
Yeah.
I mean, this can happen anywhere. But the psychological mechanism is that the tests are not repeated, but there are variations in the tests to avoid the processes that can take place, as you're suggesting. Can people learn how to take tests and know the right answer to give, even if it's not the correct answer for them?
When we come back, we'll find out more about airline pilot psychology on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. Dr. Raymond Hamden on the phone with me, clinical and forensic psychologist. We're discussing airline pilot psychology. Raymond, statistics of accidents due to psychological state of the pilot has been very, very rare. Would you agree with me?
I'm not sure if rare is the term I would use. or not investigated, simply because we do know that most airplane accidents are due to pilot error. Mm-hmm. Seldom are they to mechanical failure. However, are we looking at the pilot's psychology, or are we looking at other factors that could be involved? Like, for instance, we know that sleep deprivation can create much havoc on a person's body and psychology. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to call that the patient's psychology, then it's so be it. But how many times can we go back and tell if that pilot has had sleep deprivation? We know that with sleep deprivation, which is now called insomnia, no longer meaning no sleep, but it means any kind of sleep disturbance, can create 60% more medical problems. We also know that from various accidents, whether it's car accidents or even nuclear mine accidents, these have been traced back to sleep deprivation. Even with children who have sleep problems, we see hyperactivity 30% more than usual. With adults, we see a lot of concerns in their concentration, their reaction time, even their ability to remember things and learn when there's sleep deprivation. So on one hand, yes, the investigation of a pilot's psychology has different variations, but how much of it can we actually discover? How much can we actually know? Did that pilot have problems in sleeping the night before? Or are there hidden problems like consumption of drugs or alcohol that were well hidden? Are there other concerns that are going on that are shaping themselves that no one has discovered, like emotional disturbances, family issues? So there's many functions that could be going on that we would not be able to discover unless we involve the family. And sometimes the family doesn't even know what's going on with the loved one who happens to be a pilot.
Yeah. Have airline companies taken all of this into consideration? I mean, with time and with research coming out and findings, you know, by psychologists like yourself, for an example, have airline companies come up with methods to counter or to aid or help or support these pilots when they actually go to work?
Disappointingly, again, it comes back to economics. Is it economically feasible for airline companies to put that much money into a psychological system? Now, we do see most reputable airlines will have a department of psychology, but then are they actually run by qualified psychologists, or is it one of the companies that says, oh, I have a buddy over here that has a degree somewhere, sometime, but they're not really licensed or passed any exams or have been peer-reviewed? So there's always that question, why would a company invest that kind of money when they look at things statistically, not humanistically?
Existing in place, for an example, has a plane's cockpit designed to help the pilot or make his life a little easier?
Psychologists who specialize in industrial psychology, and in particular human factors engineering, are the ones who do look at the cockpit, to look at comfort, to also look at the eye movement, so they can determine which instrument needs to be visually available at what location. Eye scanning, where does the human being usually look? And if they come from a language background that reads from right to left or left to right, is that going to influence where the instrumentation actually is? Are they better off with a yoke or with a stick? How does the rudder function? You know, where are the other panel buttons and visual references? So human factors engineers are the ones that determine these things, and usually they're pretty good about it. Everything from where do the numbers line up on a telephone to what instruments are placed where on the panel board of a cockpit.
What about interaction between pilot and co-pilot? Psychologically, how does one get prepared for that? Because you often are flying with a different person all the time. Do these interactions help with the psychological well-being?
It depends on the airline. We have airlines that actually try to keep the same crew together, and those seem to work out quite well because people get used to each other. But sometimes getting used to each other can be a problem because eventually they take things for granted. But mm-hmm. then The airlines that are reputable airlines have very strict guidelines, and no matter how many times that pilot and co-pilot and navigator have flown, they each time have to take out the book, read the diagrams, read the bullet points on the guidelines for starting and stopping the airplane. So usually the system is set up in a very constructive fashion to where there's no room for that kind of error. But it does sometimes happen. There's some airlines who prefer to change people around. Mm-hmm. But there's also sometimes a person that might have a personal issue going on and they've got to trade off a flight with somebody else. But usually the cockpit has people who are very familiar with each other. Even if they may change around in the cockpit, they did ground school together. They probably were in the same training program together. They may have even been recruited from the same country or industry of their country of origin together. So the statistics on that I'm not really clear on, or the latest statistics on, is it better to have people from who are constantly together or always changing or somewhere in between?
Are pilots always thrown into crisis situations? I mean, just off on the ground, that is, when to train for such emergencies, if they do in fact occur, because it is quite rare. We do know that airline accidents are quite don't happen all the time. And hence, how often do you need to be thrown in this emergency situation in order to react as quickly as possible?
The airlines that I've been involved with are quite strict about pilot training. Even if they're not up in the air during their 20 hours a month or however many hours they're obligated to fly, they're in the simulators. And in those simulators, they're always checked. Some airlines actually have a check once a month. Sometimes they'll bring in somebody spontaneously to sit in the spotter's chair in the cockpit. And usually, airlines won't even tolerate 10% error, whether it's coming down the ILS or whether it's taking off or in any aspect on the ground. So there's many functions that take place on a daily basis. Pilots are not just up in the air and then they go home and sit around with the family doing nothing until the next flight. Mm-hmm. Most airlines require that their pilots are in the cockpit on a regular basis, in a simulator on a regular basis, and they will simulate various kinds of problems so that the pilot has some kind of simulation experience on these accidents that could happen.
Are there innate psychological attributes which make a better pilot?
A person who is self-controlled, a person who is able to think before they react, but in an expeditious fashion. And this is the person on a regular basis, given that there's no accident. A person who likes to deal with the facts and the details, and a person who can make decisions without allowing their emotions to interfere with those decisions, and a person who's planned, decisive, and orderly. Those are the characteristics that are usually associated with a good pilot. An emergency pilot, a pilot who is functioning on experimental aircraft, a person who is ready for the problems, would need to have an added feature of being creative and imaginative in a very quick response, where they can be very transparent in their moves. They can verbalize what they need to get done to get it done quickly. They can also be spontaneous when it comes to reacting rather than waiting too long for a hazard to continue happening. So there's two levels that a person needs to be prepared for to be a good pilot. However, the pilots that are trained are not always trained for emergencies because there's not that many accidents. But there can be some errors. Like, for instance, when flying in and out of an airport, there may have been some control tower problems in which two airplanes may be getting too close to each other. Well, at that moment, that skilled pilot needs to know how to get out of the way of danger to go into some type of a flight pattern or a missed approach pattern to be able to protect the aircraft and the people that's in it. So the usual indication is that a pilot is able to think before they react. They're able to function with the details and facts. They're able to make decisions without the emotions. And they're able to be planned, decisive, and orderly. And with that, they can still have the flexibility and adaptability for an emergency situation.
And that comes very much with your psychological state?
Well, of course. A person who is focused means that they don't have personal garbage that might be going on in their lives that cause them to be distressed or deviate from the thinking that they need to be focused on. And there's also nothing that is medically in their bodies, prescribed or non-prescribed, that could interfere with their response time.
In the event of a crash, Raymond, how is a psychological autopsy conducted?
The psychological autopsies only can involve those who are living. And circumstances that are known when you don't have people that you can talk to are to discover the elements that exist within the remains of the body or the object that has been subject to a crash. Now, in the psychological autopsy, what we are looking for is discovery of facts. But those facts may not be able to be substantiated. So it becomes very difficult, and also it's going to be sometimes impossible to verify. So what you can do is gather information that might be assumptions at best.
It is very difficult, isn't it? Because how do you pin down the psychological state of someone who's not around?
What we are doing now is we go back to relatives, friends, the point of contact with anyone or any place in the last 24 to 48 hours or even 1 week of that individual's life existence. And we ask the questions to people. We look around at the environment to see if there's any clues that might give us an indication of what could have been going on in that person's mind that may have affected not only their psychological state, but possibly even their physical state.
Do you just present your findings after which a decision is made after looking at a holistic picture more than anything else?
Well, when you're presenting findings, you try to have the findings backed up with some type of evidence. But not everything can be evidence-based. So what you do in making assumptions, you have to qualify that these are assumptions. There's no way we can ever be 100% sure, but the closer we can get to being 99% sure, the more acceptable the validity as well as the reliability of the information that we're presenting.
Raymond, in view of MH370, and you know we are still trying to figure out what really happened, what would you like to leave us with, passengers, especially people, the Malaysians, who are considering flying? What advice would you give us to help ease this anxiety that we may have?
The world is in empathy with Malaysia. This could have happened to any of us anywhere in the world. And it just proves that humans are humans all the way around the world, that no matter what's happening politically or with religious differences or economic status, people care about each other. And people around the world are glued to the television, wondering what's happening to that situation, and more importantly, how are the families doing? How are the loved ones doing? Everyone needs closure. Everyone needs an answer. It's not unusual to see an outburst of people with anger, and they're blaming government, they're blaming the industry. They need to pinpoint anyone or any entity to get the answers, and that's what they want. And sometimes, even if we don't like the answer, we need the truth, because the truth shall make us free. And with this, that closure is so important. So it's not unusual for those loved ones who all of us sympathize with and empathize with to go through the denial that this has happened, to be angry that it's happened, to go through the bargaining process of, I wish I could have my loved one back, just to hold them for another moment, to let them know how I feel. And when we try to make things corrected by denying, being angry, or bargaining them back, and we realize it can't work, we'll turn that outward energy of trying to correct things against ourselves. And that outward energy turned inward is depression, where we feel hopeless, helpless, that we're psychologically impotent. Eventually, we do get to acceptance. And with that acceptance, we may not forget the person, but we will forgive the death of that person.
It's just a journey we'll have to go through, isn't it?
It's a process that everyone has to go through, and it's not good to take medication because that only stops the symptom process. It doesn't take care of the cause of the symptoms, and that can delay the resolution and coming to an acceptance, and that is not healthy. People going through depression, through grief, through bereavement, through mourning, that's normal. You don't take medication to stop a normal process, nor do you try to avoid or escape from it. People have to deal with it. And because we have specialists who are involved in the critical incident debriefing there, that helps process even quicker. There's no way you can stop the pattern, but the process of the pattern can be expedited. And that's what's going to be helpful. But for the world, not just the wonderful people of Malaysia, but for the world, we all need closure on what really happened.
Thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Raymond.
I hope the next time we speak, it'll be because of a pleasant occasion.
I hope so, too. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Dr. Raymond Hamden, clinical and forensic psychologist on Airline Pilot Psychology on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.